This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm NBC News Chief Washington Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
Rick, we got some news overnight. The President of the United States will be addressing a joint session of Congress. We often call these State of the Union addresses. We usually have them in February. I think occasionally they could even be late January. But we got a date. It's not really a State of the Union because he's the incoming president here. So it's a speech to the joint session, and it will be on April 28th. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about a big announcement the president is making today about Afghanistan. But just to set the stage here, Rick, we are going to be talking today to a good friend of mine named Neil King, who is on a most extraordinarily interesting journey by foot. So I don't want us to go on too long with this trivial stuff. I want us to get to this conversation with Neil. But just to kind of put that teaser out there, a remarkable story. We talked to somebody literally in the middle of this journey. You'll hear all about it.
Yeah, it's amazing, John, that you could actually travel on foot anywhere these days. Neil's doing some great work, and I look forward to that conversation.
When you look at this speech to the joint session that we now know, we now have a time. This is going to be, corresponding, pretty closely to wrapping up his 100 days. And by the way, we can define the 100 days a couple different ways, I've learned. There's the first 100 days of the new Congress. There's the first 100 days of the president. And I guess, given that this presidency got off to a weird start because there was an impeachment trial of Trump that started off, you could probably count also the first 100 days after the end of all of that, but there are some extraordinary restrictions put on this because we still are in the middle of COVID. We still can't have a packed House chamber like we would normally expect to see. This is going to look very different.
Yeah, and everything around Congress is different these days. So we'll have severe restrictions on how many people can be there, how many members of the press can be there. John, you're always there. Are you going to break your streak this year, though?
I've been there for more than a decade straight, every single one inside the chamber. And I first went inside the chamber back in 2003, I believe it was, under George W. Bush. So I've been doing this for a long, long time. But no, I'm not going to be there.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm not going to be there. I'll be part of our broadcast coverage on the set in New York. But Rick, I mean, I'm looking at some of the restrictions here. I mean, one kind of background briefing that our team was given on this said that not all the senators would be allowed to attend. I mean, would you want to be on that committee deciding which senators wouldn't be allowed to come into the State of the Union?
Maybe it'll make life easy for some people that might be thinking they should boycott it. I don't know.
Please.
It's an interesting moment in the presidency, and because wherever you want to define 100 days, I've been reading an interesting book by Douglas Brinkley, the great historian, about called American Moonshot, about JFK. And in that book, he talks about JFK going back to Congress for a second time early in 1961 in his presidency. And that was that second time in May of 61 that he gave the famous, we will go to the moon at the end of this, this decade. And that's one of the defining moments of the Kennedy years and of the 1960s. And it came at that second address. And I feel like now you have a president who, COVID certainly isn't gone, but he is confronting actively the challenge of his time, or maybe any time, maybe of a century, and now trying to do more and outlining a further vision. In a presidency that's been, however you want to count the 100 days, he hasn't been visible for all those 100 days. It's not like the first 100 days or 100 hours of the Trump White House years where the president was everywhere. There's been long stretches where even people like you and I who get paid to watch this stuff, the president has not been top of mind. So to reset that at the end of this period, toward the end of that 100 days, to look forward about what's next for him, whether that's the big infrastructure push, maybe some challenges in foreign policy he'll be talking about, it comes at a pretty fascinating moment. The president is still pretty popular, very narrow control of both the House and the Senate, and a big question mark about what else he tries to get done or can get done.
And he's announcing now that U.S. troops will be fully withdrawn from Afghanistan by September 11th, 2021, which, of course, is the 20th anniversary of 9/11. It's, by the way, I think it's interesting this is something that Donald Trump was eager to do and been often pushed back heavily by his own national security team. Trump wanted to get out of Afghanistan. I know from the very beginning he was talking about getting out immediately. And one of the frustrations that he expressed, by the way, a frustration not entirely unlike the frustration Obama sometimes expressed, but was about the heavy pushback from, I guess Obama would call it the Ben Rhodes, Obama's foreign policy advisor, deputy national security advisor, described as the blob, what Trump allies would describe as the deep state. But it's very hard to actually do this. But Biden, who's been talking about withdrawing from Afghanistan for a long time, I mean, actually, he said he would do it in the debate that Martha Raddatz hosted back in 2012 when he debated, VP candidate Paul Ryan. And it didn't happen. But now he's adamant. U.S. troops gone. 20 years is enough. There will always be a reason to stay. It's time to get out. You know, I mean, this is a direction that Obama wanted to go as well. But
yes, but as you know, John, I mean, their foreign policy, even behind closed doors, was never perfectly aligned. And Biden came into those Obama years, having been the chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee. Part of the kind of permanent establishment around these things, maybe less of an automatic contrarian than Obama was in confronting challenges like this. And it is interesting because we're seeing a lot of criticism come in, I think predictable criticism from the right, Republicans saying you're cutting and running. You know, they were a little quieter when it was Trump talking about doing the same sort of thing. In fact, we know President Biden is moving about 6 months slower than President Trump said he would. But it's a big first test or early test of Biden's vision on foreign policy. As we know, he never always won those debates inside the Obama White House. And a lot of folks in and around Obama were glad he wasn't winning those debates. Now he's the decision maker. Now he's the guy that's pulling the strings. And he's the one that's making this, relative, pretty dramatic announcement on the 20th anniversary.
And it is interesting to see it tied to a symbolic, moment on the calendar. And of course, national security challenges don't usually, neatly cooperate with a political calendar. But I think that the way Biden is looking at this is, you've got to set a deadline. You've got to do it. You've got to make the break. Because again, there will always be a reason why you cannot leave. You need to force it.
And it ends up being a pretty key commitment for him to keep, because it's something that he has said consistently as a candidate for president, and as you said, as a candidate for vice president. So to see it come to this moment, we'll see if it has to slide again. That's been another part of the history around these seemingly never-ending conflicts, the forever wars, as they're sometimes being called. And I think it's also worth noting here that it's been a big touchstone on the left to see an end to a conflict, an actual end date. There's a generation of politicians who are coming up now who were, frankly, they were kids on 9/11, and they've seen the war in Afghanistan and the U.S. troop presence there for basically their entire lives, or their entire sentient lives. And they're some of the folks who are saying, time to end this thing. We can't have wars that go on forever. We need to have this end date.
What's your sense going into this joint session speech, and as we're all starting already to take stock on the first 100 days? It seems that Biden has done a remarkable job of unifying a party which is rarely unified. He seems to have largely, there's grumbling on issue here, issue there, but the progressives seem to be largely on board. They could like what he did with the COVID relief bill. They would like this this next big infrastructure bill to be bigger, no doubt. But they like what he's doing. I mean, one Biden supporter, somebody who has been a longtime Biden supporter, said to me, you know, he kind of campaigned as a moderate, and now he's governing a little bit more like the way he would, you know, Elizabeth Warren might have. But he seems to have, by and large, kept the party on board.
He has. And to the extent that there's been sniping, it's been a little bit more in the center, the moderates who are a little more upset and keeping him in line, which is, to me, a pretty big surprise. You know, I saw someone write recently, you know, he has shown that he's no LBJ in terms of managing relationships in Congress. Clearly, he knows more about the Senate than any senator or any president since LBJ. I think that's a pretty fair assessment, given how long he spent there. Yep. But you know, keep in mind, you know, LBJ came in with, you know, majorities that were well into the 60s for Democrats. Then a lot of those Democrats were Southern Democrats who opposed them on civil rights. But it's a different to keep in mind that he's not only that he's uniting a party, but he's uniting a party with the narrowest of advantages. It's a 50-50 Senate, John. And in the House, Nancy Pelosi can lose have two defectors and still be able to carry something over the finish line. Unbelievably narrow. So that's part of what's keeping the discipline, is knowing that it doesn't take much to pick off from the other party. It's also though putting, I think, some pressure on him to show bipartisan credentials in some other ways, because he can deliver and has delivered already without any Republicans. Is he still looking for them? Do Republicans feel singed right now by the way that he's been treated, but he's treated them? And I think that, you know, this White House likes to talk to public opinion polls and say that bipartisanship means that they've got bipartisan support, Republican support as well as Democratic support. They're not getting Republican votes. That, to me, was a key promise of Biden, either implicitly or explicitly, and that is not something he's delivered on. And to the extent that that is a theme for this next phase of the Biden presidency, that'll be fascinating to watch.
And Republicans are firmly into the position, it seems to me, of he's overreaching and we are the resistance. I mean, they're fundraising off this. There's a lot of complaints about him going back on his word to work with the Republicans, but you don't get a sense that there's this groundswell of Republicans eager to make a deal on any of this stuff, frankly, with Joe Biden. And then you have the news out of Mar-a-Lago. The president gives a speech at a big event for donors over the weekend and wasn't exactly met with glowing reviews. And this is a private speech, but of course, word got out very quickly afterwards. We've talked to people that were there. And, you know, it was very much the Donald Trump that we saw going into, frankly, the Donald Trump that we saw going into January 6th.
Yeah, and look, we came into the year talking a lot about Republican divisions. Now, they get papered over by the opposition to Biden, but what is looming is what the party is for going forward. And Biden has not yet picked off any Republicans for the Biden agenda. There's been great unity, I think, now opposing the broadly constructed infrastructure package. But when you get back into the question of who represents this party moving forward, they can't quit Trump. And, you know, you and I have talked a lot about, and I know you've written about what Trump's future in the party is. That's still an open question, but clearly he's not disappeared. Clearly he's not gone. Clearly he's still a magnetic force. The fact that multiple Republican gatherings are going in and around his properties in Florida, knowing that the money, if not the man itself, are a draw at this moment, that tells you where things stand. And that's a lot of what is driving the Republican Party right now, continues to be dominated 3 months or so after he left office by the former president.
But they go down there. This is the big. This is again, as far as there is such a thing, the Republican establishment, and he comes out to speak to them, and it's all the same complaints about the election being stolen from him. He's even complaining about Mike Pence still. He's, you know, ripping apart Mitch McConnell as they're trying to fight to win back a Senate Republican majority. I mean, it's really. The party is in this situation where they know that they need Trump, or at least they think they need Trump, because they need his supporters, and they know that Trump is in many ways a disaster for them. Trump is not the path back to majority, but they can't live with him. They can't live without him. Fascinating. But Rick, let's take a quick break, and we are going to come back, and we're going to go in an entirely different direction. I think we all, I think you all enjoy this. We're going to talk again to a good friend of mine who is making a rather extraordinary walk by foot from America's current capital to its first capital. All right, welcome back to Powerhouse Politics. We are going to take a very different turn right now, and one that I'm really, really quite excited about. My friend Neil King, who is a legendary former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who I know because we covered the State Department together and traveled all over the world for the period of a few years with various secretaries of state, awesome writer, is embarked on a journey by foot. He is going from Washington, D.C., where he lives, just steps away from the Capitol, to New York, to Manhattan. And he's taking a very circuitous route. And along the way, Neil is writing these just awesome dispatches, which he tells us will become a book. I predict will be a very big hit. So when it becomes a big hit, you can say you first heard about this interesting journey by foot through the Washington-New York corridor here on Powerhouse Politics. So we'll begin our conversation. We caught up with Neil while he was walking through Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Here it is. I have to say, this is some of the most wonderful writing, fresh new writing that I have read in some time, and it's the first thing I turn to. I want to see if I've gotten your latest, you know, your latest write up. These stories, your observations of this area. And again, you're taking a meandering trip. You're not literally walking up I-95. That wouldn't be very interesting. Your observations are incredible. But I want to kind of dig down into a couple of these, if you don't mind, Neil.
Are you sure?
And this is classic. You constantly find these people either in real life today or from our deep, distant past. And I have no idea how you come up with these people, but Johannes Kelpius, who was running around Pennsylvania about the in the 1690s, and your description of him kind of caught my eye, because you said Kelpius was a pietist, a mystic, and a doomsayer, which I immediately thought of our executive producer of this podcast, Trevor Hastings. it's often the way I think of him. Can you describe this? You come across this cave. I mean, go ahead. Tell me this story.
Well, I mean, part of the thing that's been fascinating about walking is that you're stringing one step after the other, one person met after the other. It alters everything. The 3 miles an hour thing alters everything. And so it is a very much where one thing leads to another. So oddly enough, I went to another extraordinary place in Philadelphia called Eastern State Penitentiary, which, by the way, was one of the main reasons that de Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, came to America in 1831, was to visit this penitentiary, which at that time was brand new. And when I was there, I was talking to a guy who led me around and showed me everything. And he told me about this hermit's cave, this cave where this guy Kelpius had lived. And I just was like, oh my God, I've got to go check that out. The thing that was fascinating about not so much him, but why he went to this place that I went to, is that when he arrived in Philadelphia was basically brand new. It was 1694. And he was part of this sort of cult that thought the world was about to end. So they wanted to go into the wilderness. And at the time, the wilderness was like 6 miles from Philadelphia. So when I went there yesterday, part of it was kind of a humorous thing to see, like, well, what did the outer reaches of the wilderness, so to speak, look like then? And of course, it didn't look much like wilderness now. I mean, didn't look like wilderness much at the moment. But anyway, the fun thing about the walk is you just don't know who's going to mention something that will lead you to the next place. I met a guy a week ago or so, and he mentioned a place called Yellow Springs, which is also always outside of Philadelphia, and he said it was the first ever U.S. military hospital. And I was like, wow, that's incredible. So I walked there. I think, you know, I'm going to turn all this into a book, and I think one of the themes is going to be during a period now when we're so rethinking our history and tearing down statues and deciding the many things we don't like about the country, which I think is fine in a lot of ways healthy, this kind of reckoning. But I also think we should try to unearth and reemerge the things that are there to be celebrated about our own past and about our own character as this kind of eccentric, adventure-seeking people. And, all of this stuff was a huge experiment at the time when the people first came and settled these places. And there's a lot of aspects of our history that I'm kind of going to look at or in case of speak to people about. And a lot of it is trying to kind of, unearth these aspects of our past that are worth thinking about anew.
I mean, another guy that you unearth who seems to be having somewhat of a renaissance is this guy Benjamin Lay, who was a Quaker. He was basically excommunicated.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the first abolitionists. He was a 4 foot tall dwarf, basically, that was like a hunchback. He was almost like a performance artist and kind of provocateur. And again, there aren't statues around for somebody like Benjamin Lay, but he was one of the forces that convinced the Quakers to renounce slavery. And the Quakers were in turn one of the primary forces that really drove the abolitionist movement in America, without which, who knows exactly where our history would have gone over that stretch. So these kinds of individuals are really fascinating, important. And he was just a total quirky oddball who deserves more attention.
Yeah. You point out that, he kind of was calling for a boycott before we knew what a boycott was. Among the loudest of America's abolitionists, long before boycotts, he urged the Quakers to eschew the products created through slavery, including tea, sugar, and coffee. He was a dwarf, a hunchback, and a lifelong vegetarian. I just love the freaking detail. It's so great. But I want to ask you, you ended up in a Quaker meeting house. I have to say, this was one point where your writing kind of lost me a little bit, but I loved being lost in this. I don't even know what you're talking about, frankly, here, but you go to this meeting house, it has a retractable roof or something. Is this right? And it's right before sunset. I may be getting it all wrong, but I just want to read.
No, that's right. That's right.
Okay. I just want to read what you wrote. And this is where you actually wrote this in your just notebook. And then you just let it pour out onto the page here. So these are your raw, unedited notes that you let us see. You're lying on your back in a Quaker meeting house. It has a retractable roof that has been opened right as the sun is setting. This is Neil King, ladies and gentlemen, writing this. A cloth-like fabric of oceanic green, luxuriantly smooth, begins to turn blue and impose itself, pushing inward, a radiant periwinkle blue. As the ceiling went slowly pink, the sky turns intensely green, clover green. There is no sky, only color. Then splotchy gray, monochromatically gray, to radiant purple. It is now the softest, gauzy baby pink. I'm going to keep going. As the ceiling goes blue, the sky turns pale gray. It becomes greenish, yellow, like old newsprint. Then back to oceanic green. The sky becomes so solidly green, you're convinced that there is no sky there. None at all. Burnt orange, now protruding into the room. The ceiling turns taupe and the sky a light, pale, radiant blue. All of it in Rothko hues. You want to see a star passing or a plane to prove it is the sky. The eye creates stars where there are no stars. Finally, just a solid, intensely black. And you assure me there were no drugs involved in the writing of this.
Oh my God, John, that was such a great reading. That's hilarious. No, I mean, it deserves a little explanation. So there's actually quite well-known artist, James Turrell. He does these installations. They're called skyscapes. There are about 80 of them around the world. They rely on an enclosed space where the roof is then able to open up to the sky. And it was about an 8x9, rectangle. And then over 50 minutes, there are various changes to the roof, the color of the roof. And what it's basically doing is showing you kind of what an optical illusion is for all of us when it comes to color, because you're seeing these things that, yes, they are the sky, but it's in contrast to the things that are going on the ceiling itself. So all those descriptions were actually quite accurate descriptions of the sky itself. But it was, and so at the end they said, Neil, do you have any questions? And I was like, yeah, like, why are we doing this in a house of worship? Because it's basically saying everything is relative, and doubt it should be where you start from, because it's so kind of flabbergasting. So,
well, one of the things I love is just the way people greet you, and I think some people think you're odd for doing this. Some people are quite fascinated. Some people are kind of nonplussed. But the little moments, I mean, there was the one you just mentioned, I think maybe it was even today, you mentioned this on Twitter or yesterday, that you wanted to play tennis. You're a tennis player, but I mean, you're traveling with what? You have a backpack and you're walking, right? I mean, you don't have you don't have a convoy that's like really secretly like following you along, supplying you, right? I mean, So you're just walking. How the hell are you going to play tennis? But you came across, some tennis courts, and there were a couple of people playing that were wrapping up, and, you know, you asked if you could play. And of course that meant, hey, can I borrow one of your rackets?
Yeah, I know. You know, the thing is, I just want to say that the difference between walking and driving is about 20, it's a factor of 20. You drive 60, you walk 3 miles an hour.
Right.
The difference in interacting with people is also about a factor of 20. I mean, I had all these experiences with Mennonites and others along the way that would have been impossible if I'd been in a car, because I wouldn't have seen them. They wouldn't have wanted to interact with me the same way if I pulled into their driveway, if I was parking and playing. You know, it's hard to overstate how different it is that you become as a person, but also your interaction. So when those two guys, they were both, by the way, Asian Americans, their English was sort of spotty, but they were really funny. They had a great tennis game. I was kind of acting as a line judge when they were playing. And at the end I said, hey, and one of them was like, sure, I'll play with you. And so if I had pulled up in my car and jumped out, it might've been a little strange, but the fact that he could see that I was a walker, like, contextualized everything differently. So the way we interacted was from a different, more kind of directly human point of view. And that's the thing that's been fascinating. I've encountered people because my phone battery ran out and I need a direction, you know, like, so it's sort of forcing a degree of human contact that a lot of us, I guess, have lost because technology has made it easier to get by without asking for directions, for instance.
By the way, your photos are great too. And then you also, you had that experience where you ran into, was it a Mennonite who wanted you to give a message to somebody?
That whole story. Yeah.
So just briefly, because this is a mix. These are people that do not engage in technology, but tell me that story.
Well, I'll tell you the quick version of that story, because it was really quite amazing. It's almost like a parable. I'm walking down a highway in northern Maryland. I come to a bridge that's too narrow to cross without risking my life. I take a detour down a little road to the left. I run into this couple. They're in their 70s. We talk. They wonder where I'm going. I tell them I'm going through Lancaster County on my way to New York. They say, oh my gosh, we used to live in Lancaster County. We live in a town called Ephrata. I said, I'm going to Ephrata. They said, oh, we live with this farm family, the name of Hoover. They live on Crooked Lane there. We haven't talked to them for years. I said, wait, I'm going there. I will go to their farm and tell them that you're well. And they were dumbfounded. And they were like, you will? And I was like, yeah, of course. So I made it a point a week later when I got there to go to Crooked Lane and find these farmers. And these are horse and buggy type Mennonites. And I arrive at their 88-acre farm and bring news of good tidings that their friends are well. And they didn't quite know what to make, but once they did, they were just sort of astonished and amazed. And we stood there and talked with each other for, 20, 25 minutes. And it was a conversation I've never had the likes of in my life, and it was fascinating. And so that's the kind of thing that can happen.
It was great. And I think you also say that you offered to show them a picture on your phone of their friend, and they're like, no, we don't.
Yeah, I don't even think the guy had ever looked at a phone before.
We're not going to do that kind of thing. Hey, Neil King, you broke some news for me in this interview, and I don't mean about Johannes Kelpius. You said you were going to turn this into a book. I was going to ask you to please turn this into a book. I'm glad to hear that is the game plan. I think this is an incredible story. Your observations Your observations are really fun and important. And I hope the walk continues. I mean, when you get to New York, I mean, you know, you're getting all the steps and I hope you can find, I hope this is just the first leg, but thank you. Thank you for taking a break. I don't want to keep you going. How many miles a day are you doing?
15, 16, basically something like that. It varies.
Okay. Yeah. All right. All right. Well, I don't want to hold you. You got to get back out there, man.
No. I'm fine. I'm good. John, great to catch up. Fantastic to talk.
Great to catch up. We'll talk to you later, Neil.
Take care. Bye.
And that is all the time we have for Powerhouse Politics. I want to thank our entire Powerhouse Politics team and, particularly our pietist and mystic and doomsayer executive director, but also Adia Robinson and Rick Klein, wherever he is. We will be back next week.